It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
We'd much rather be ahead of the curve than behind it, and that's what we are. Therefore, my administration is recommending that all Americans, including the young and healthy, work to engage in schooling from home when possible, avoid gathering in groups of more than 10 people, avoid discretionary travel, and avoid eating and drinking at bars, restaurants, and public food courts. If everyone makes this change or these critical changes and sacrifices now, we will rally together as one nation. And we will defeat the virus, and we're going to have a big celebration all together. With several weeks of focused action, we can turn the corner and turn it quickly.
All right, that was the president yesterday in his daily address to the nation, daily press conferences, asking all the questions that can be asked every single day with all of his staff. And so now more and more restaurants are being closed, bars are being closed, not in every area of the country, but lots of areas. He's suggesting no groups greater than 10, so you can imagine what all that's going to affect. You know, I've had 24 hours to think about this and pray about this, and I shared with you yesterday my really anxious heart that we were being manipulated with facts and information and worried about that. And I have a little different take on it this morning. After just reflecting, I listened to what some of you said yesterday, and I listened to a lot of my other friends, and this is what my impression is this morning, is I think, look, our government, our states, or whatever, they are laying down some parameters, and I do think we have to honor those parameters. Whether or not this is all hysteria, we will find out. In time, we will find out. Meanwhile, I agree that we have to cooperate. It's that they're not asking us to do anything immoral. And so we cooperate with the government and the authorities in trying to constrain this. And I also, someone said this on, one of the callers said this yesterday, and others that I talked to yesterday said something similar, that there is an element of this that is kind of uniting the country. The one thing that occurred to me was that, you know, most Americans, which is such a really tremendous aggravation to me and frustration, and also just worry, that Americans are not engaged. They're not paying attention. They live their lives in an isolated way already, not plugged into what's happening in the world, not really caring. I think that's changing. Look, every single American is now paying attention, and that can't be bad. And I do think that there is a sense of like working together to get past this. So that can't be bad either, even though I still would say that this is an overreaction. But all right, so we're going to cooperate with this overreaction, and we're going to find out on the other side of it how serious this really was, and if healthcare professionals were manipulating, you know, the authorities, we don't know. But sometimes things are above your pay grade, you know. You can't know all of these things. These are things we speculate about. So we will work together to cooperate as best we can, and I have some great things to share with you this morning, and I'm going to do that. My husband. My husband actually is in Nashville working with 8 Days of Hope, trying to restore homes down there in Nashville after those horrible tornadoes of what? How it sounds like, you know, it feels like a year ago, but it was only a few weeks ago. And so he sent me this yesterday, and I want to share it with you. It's wise words from C.S. Lewis in 1948. C.S. Lewis, of course, the converted atheist, a professor at Oxford, writer famous for the Chronicles of Narnia and all of the other things he's famous for, Mere Christianity, one of his favorite famous books, a lecturer on the BBC during World War II. This is what C.S. Lewis had to say. Now, again, this is written in 1948. In one way, we think a great deal too much of the atomic bomb. How are we to live in an atomic age? I am tempted to reply, why, as you would have lived in the 16th century when the plague visited London almost every year, or as you would have lived in the Viking Age when raiders from Scandinavia might land and cut your throat any night, or indeed as you are already living in an age of cancer, an age of syphilis, an age of paralysis, an age of air raids, an age of railway accidents, an age of motor accidents. In other words, do not let us begin by exaggerating the novelty of our situation. Believe me, dear sir or madam, you and all whom you love were already sentenced to death before the atomic bomb was invented, and quite a high percentage of us were going to die in unpleasant ways. We had indeed one very great advantage over our ancestors, anesthetics, but we have that still. It is perfectly ridiculous to go about whimpering and drawing long faces because the scientists have added one more chance of painful and premature death to a world which already bristled with such chances and in which death itself was not a chance at all, but a certainty. This is the first point to be made, and the first action to be taken is to pull ourselves together. If we are all going to be destroyed by an atomic bomb, let that bomb, when it comes, find us doing sensible and human things, praying, working, teaching, reading, listening to music, bathing the children, playing tennis, chatting to our friends over a pint and a game of darts, not huddled together like frightened sheep and thinking about bombs. They may break our bodies, a microbe can do that, but they need not dominate our minds. And that was his little piece called On Living in an Atomic Age in 1948, C.S. Lewis. Isn't that something? We'll post that on our Facebook page because I think that's certainly worth sharing. And then that reminds me a couple of things. Oh, let me just add something practical here. This is an election day in Illinois, Arizona, Florida, very important elections, especially in Illinois. There are two Freedom Caucus. There are two women running. In Illinois, it's Jeannie Ives and Mary. I didn't bring her last name, but she's running in Southern Illinois. She is both of them are endorsed by the Freedom Caucus. They've said that they intend to join. They've got the qualifications. And so that's two races that I know about in Illinois to pay attention to. But if you live in Arizona or Florida, you know about other races. Some of these are just presidential primaries. Some states do not combine other candidates, but Illinois does. Ohio has called off their elections. So Bernie Sanders, by the way, ended up losing Washington State. It went to Joe Biden. So those are just some of the things about the election that I want to share with you. I might come back to that. But I want to get to this. Today is, guess what today is? It's St. Patrick's Day. You know, all the parades have been canceled everywhere. No one dares go out. And yet it is St. Patrick's Day. And when you think of St. Patrick's Day, you think maybe of Ireland, and you think of, shamrocks, and you think of St. Patrick because it is his day. So I used to, in the past, when I had a longer show, I did 3 hours in Chicago on drive time, I used to always have a guest talking about who St. Patrick was, and believe me, he's probably not who you think he is. And I'm going to take a second to read from Bill Federer this morning, American Minute. Bill is a historian. He's often my guest. It's been a while, but I want you to know about St. Patrick's Day. And this is from Bill's piece, which we'll also post about St. Patrick on our Facebook page. Ireland was ruled by the bloodthirsty, superstitious, pagan Druids. The Romans, in their first encounters with these exposed, insane warriors, were shocked and frightened. They were howling, and it seemed, possessed by demons. So outrageous was their strength, featuring all the terrors of hell itself. The Druids, from whom Halloween originated, believed that the trees and the hills were inhabited by good and evil spirits, which had to be appeased. This is all written by a guy named Thomas Cahill, who wrote a book called How the Irish Saved Civilization. Okay. So Cahill continued, the Druids sacrificed prisoners of war to the war gods and newborns to the harvest gods. Believing that the human head was the seat of the soul, they displayed proudly the heads of their enemies in their temples and on their palisades. They even hung them from their belts as ornaments, used them as footballs in victory celebrations, and were fond of employing skull tops as ceremonial drinking bowls. They also sculpted heads, both shrunken, decapitated heads. Patrick's, meaning St. Patrick, his British name at birth was Sukkot. Remember now, this is back before Britain was Britannia. It was not, you know, London. It was not England. It was back, this is like in the 400s. So St. Patrick's British name was Sukkot. It was Latin. His Latin name was Patricius, meaning nobleman. Around 405 AD, at the age of 16, while working at his father's farm near the sea, 50 longboats filled with raiders weaved their way toward the shore. Mary Cagney, the author of Patrick the Saint, wrote this: with no Roman army to protect them, Roman legions had long since deserted Britain to protect Rome from barbarian invasions. Patricius at St. Patrick and his town were unprepared for the attack. The Irish warriors, wearing helmets and armed with spears, descended on the pebble beach. The braying war horn struck terror in Patricius's heart, and he started to run toward town. The warriors quickly demolished the village, and as Patricius darted among the burning houses and screaming women, he was caught. The barbarians dragged him aboard a boat bound for the east coast of Ireland. For 6 years, Patrick, who was to become St. Patrick, Patricius, herded animals for a Druid chieftain. He later wrote in his life story called The Confession of St. Patrick, quote, "But after I came to Ireland, every day I had to tend the sheep, and many times a day I prayed. The love of God and his fear came to me more and more, and my faith was strengthened. And my spirit was moved so that in the single day I would say as many as 100 prayers, and almost as many in the night. And this was even when I was staying in the woods and on the mountains, and I used to get up for prayer before daylight, through snow, through frost, through rain. There the Lord opened the sense of my unbelief, that I might at last remember my sins and be converted with all my heart to the Lord my God, who comforted me as would a father his son." Then Patrick had a dream. "One night I heard in my sleep a voice saying to me, 'It is well that you fast. Soon you will go to your own country.' And again a voice saying to me, 'See, your ship is ready.' And it was not near, but at a distance of perhaps 200 miles. Then I took to flight. I went in the strength of God who directed my way until I came to that ship." Patrick eventually made his way back to Britain and was reunited with what was left of his family. Remember, he was, what, 12 when he was taken, and 7 years, something like that, had passed? Then when he was about 40 years old, he had another dream calling him back to Ireland as a missionary. Patrick wrote, "In the depth of the night, I saw a man named Victoricus coming as if from Ireland with innumerable letters, and he gave me one. And while I was reading, I thought I heard the voice of those near the Western Sea call out, 'Please, holy boy, come and walk among us again.' Their cry pierced my very heart, and I could read no more. And so I awoke." Patrick did return to Ireland. He confronted the Druids, he converted the chieftains, and used the three-leaf clover to teach the Trinity. The Druids tried to ambush and kill Patrick nearly a dozen times. "Daily I expect murder, fraud, or captivity, but I fear none of these things because of the promises of heaven. The merciful God often freed me from slavery and from 12 dangers in which my life was at stake, not to mention numerous plots. God, who is my witness, who knows all things even before they come to pass, as he used to forewarn even me of many things by a divine message. I came to Ireland, to the people of Ireland, to preach the gospel and to suffer insult from the unbelievers. I am prepared to give even my life without hesitation and most gladly for his name, and it is there that I wish to spend it until I die." That's St. Patrick, and I thought you might not know that. This is, again, in 400 AD. No, 400 BC, sorry. This is during Roman times, and it's just a fabulous story. Because the Catholic Church developed into what it is now, they, of course, made Patrick a saint, and they applied all of the things that they engage in now to him. But honestly, he was an evangelist, a Christian evangelist of the early centuries who understood the Word of God. I don't care if he was, you know, I don't know if he ever called himself Catholic. Doesn't matter. But what he did was convert and change the island of Ireland. And it was just an amazing story. You can read more of it from Bill Federer. We'll put it on our Facebook page. Okay, so this is St. Patrick's Day. All right, so meanwhile, back in our time, the Congress has been up to, well, some good, but also some no good. I'll be right back.
Here's Dan Steiner, president of Preborn, a ministry dedicated to helping save preborn babies from abortion through ultrasound.
I sense God's broken heart over the issue of abortion. You see, he sees every little baby that's being formed in the mother's womb, and it breaks his heart to see when the lifetime that he has planned for them is taken from them violently so often.
Preborn is the direct competition to Planned Parenthood. By letting a mother see her baby on ultrasound and hear her baby's heartbeat, she'll choose life 80% of the time. For $140, you can sponsor 5 ultrasounds, and you'll receive a story and a picture of babies whose lives were spared. To donate, dial pound 250 and say the keyword baby. That's pound 250 and say baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com. Your love can save a life.
This is Pause to Pray, a chance to stop down from the daily noise of life and pray for our country's leaders.
Today we pray for Andre Hintz, Deputy Undersecretary for Science and Technology at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. His office is responsible for our nation's safety as it relates to terrorism, border and cybersecurity, and disaster prevention and management. 2 Thessalonians 3:3 reminds us of the protection we seek from evil in this world. But the Lord is faithful, and he will strengthen you and protect you from the evil one. Right now, with this in mind, let's pray together. Almighty God, we ask for guidance for Andre Hintz in his role at the Department of Homeland Security. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Pause to Pray is a service of this station and the Presidential Prayer Team, a nonprofit, nonpartisan ministry dedicated to encouraging prayer for our nation's leaders. To learn more, go to pausetopray.org.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
What do you see for the next generation? Do you see a prospering nation? Do you see hope? The future is ours to create, and Liberty University is driven to train positive influencers for our country and our culture. Our mission is to guide students toward leadership as servants of the people, defenders of freedom, and champions of truth. Discover how you can impact the next generation of champions for Christ by texting GIVE to 839-858.
We are entering a great time of uncertainty in our nation. Many Americans have been overwhelmed with fear and anxiety. Just turning on the television news is enough to send your blood pressure up a few notches, and with good reason. Restaurants and theaters are shut down across the nation. Many folks now looking for jobs. Public schools and universities are closed. So, too, many churches, grocery stores overrun, tempers flaring. No doubt the coronavirus is serious, and it's important for all of us to take protective measures. But we also have to put life in perspective. Remember this, folks. God is always in control. He is our refuge in the storm. He is our comforter in times of sorrow. He is our defender against the enemy. I lift up my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord. Take courage and comfort, friends. Turn your eyes upon Jesus, not the government. I'm Todd Starnes.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
U.S. health officials work to contain the outbreak. Lawmakers here in Washington are working to contain the economic fallout from all of this. As you mentioned, overnight, the House tweaking and approving a bill that it worked on over the weekend to address some of the concerns Americans have when it comes to COVID-19. Among the provisions in this bill would be paid emergency leave for some American workers, 2 weeks of paid sick leave for some workers, and up to 3 months of paid family and medical leave.
Senate Republicans are absolutely convinced that the House's bill can only be the beginning, just the beginning, of Congress' efforts to secure our economy and support American families.
We should be able to solve this. This is a significant challenge, but not an insurmountable one.
The White House says it fully supports the bill already approved by the House. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, he has been meeting face-to-face with lawmakers last night, expected to happen again today to discuss what comes next. He says they'll be looking for support for small and medium-sized businesses, looking for support for certain industries, no surprise there, like the airlines, hotels, and be looking at a general stimulus that he says for these industries that have been particularly hard hit. We also heard from the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. He said they need a big, bold, urgent federal action to deal deal with the crisis. The kinds of targeted measures they're putting together will mainline money into the economy and directly into the hands of families that need it most. Now, we expect that the Treasury Secretary will be able to speak with Senate Republicans later on today to give them an idea of how much this is all going to cost. That is a big question out here still this morning.
Yes, it is. And that was Mark Meredith on Fox this morning. And the bill passed, actually, I think this is the correct count. It's 363-40 in the House. And now, of course, it goes to the Senate. Now, the problem is, of course, the House has passed these spending bills of various types over and over and over again. And we know the drill, don't we? They add all kinds of things that aren't necessary, and they spend, and very few people resist. So what about this bill? The president says he supports it. Steve Mnuchin is all about it. So let's find out. Tommy Binion joins us this morning. Tommy is the vice president of government relations for the Heritage Foundation, and Tommy is all over this, and he really is one of my favorites to explain the convoluted processes that take place in the House. Tommy, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Sandy. It's great to be with you.
Tommy, first of all, is it still true that this bill, I know one was passed in the early morning hours on Saturday, and then it's passed to the House. Was it passed by what's called unanimous consent because members are not in town?
Yeah, there was a pretty major hiccup, actually. The bill had some drafting errors, no surprise there, because it was only available for a few hours before members were forced to vote on it in the early morning hours Saturday morning. And, of course, that was an arbitrary deadline because here we are on Tuesday morning and the Senate hasn't voted on it. But the House wanted to go home. They wanted to go home for the weekend. They wanted to go home for this week's recess. And so they were in a hurry to pass it. Over the weekend, it became clear this bill had some drafting errors. And so they put together an amendment. Now, the bill was 108 pages. And they put together an 87-page amendment and said, oh, don't worry, these are just technical changes. Well, your friend and mine, Congressman Louie Gohmert, said, hold up, wait a minute, that doesn't make a lot of sense. These aren't technical changes, these are substantive changes. I want to take a look. And so he was able to successfully delay the Speaker's wish to pass it by unanimous consent yesterday. He delayed it all day while he and his staff reviewed the bill, and ultimately he came to the conclusion, while he still opposes the bill, the changes made it better, so he withdrew his objection, and they did pass it by unanimous consent. But, you know, that's concerning for the bill yesterday, but I also got to say that's very concerning for the House process going forward. The House is out of town. They've delayed any plans that they have to come back indefinitely. And if they are intending on planning things by unanimous consent, the only way to stop that is for members to travel here. And, of course, we know that could be very difficult going forward. So I'm concerned about the process going forward.
Yeah, so you're saying that you're concerned that Nancy Pelosi might occur to her to pass other really bad things by unanimous consent. I mean, it's amazing, Tommy. So you're saying the congressmen and women could not even read the bill. They were just supposed to pass it on trust without the wording, without even a lot of the things that have been added later. And most congressmen, except for our friend Louie, who fought, were willing to let that happen. Is that right?
Yeah, that's basically right. I don't want to disparage the rest of the body. Of course, they were all back in their districts. This was all happening with very little information being given out. And, you know, airline travel is severely restricted, and it's dangerous at this time. So, yes, Mr. Gohmert was the only one to object. Very few of them could have objected, could have gotten here on short notice to object if they had wanted to. It's a very concerning process. You mentioned it might occur to the Speaker to pass other things. Well, she's just been delivered a brand-new bill, a 77-day reauthorization of FISA, which is the intelligence capability contained in the Patriot Act, that she'll have to pass by unanimous consent this week without her members in town. So,
How can that happen? Tommy, that's frightening. That's really very frightening. Let's go back to the coronavirus bill. It's called, you know, they always have these glowing names, Families First Coronavirus Response Act. I know you've looked at this bill on your because I know you're familiar with all the ins and outs of it. Tell us, okay, what are from your perspective some good provisions in this bill, some necessary and good provisions?
Well, so the bill is aimed at some of the specific ways that this coronavirus is uniquely going to affect individuals, families, workers, those kinds of things. The thing that makes the most sense to me is we all know that children, many children in low-income situations rely on their school lunch, which is free to them, to eat. A lot of times they're not getting breakfast at home. A lot of times they're not getting dinner at home. And that lunch meal is the best meal they're going to have all day. Their school is closed, in many cases, indefinitely. So the SNAP expansion makes a lot of sense to me. It's expensive. I don't like expanding government benefits, but it's just the reality that there are going to be kids who depend on a meal that they no longer have. And so that makes sense to me. You know, some ability for firms of all sizes to be able to pay their employees in a situation where they have to stay home on some level is really, really necessary. And it's necessary not just for economic reasons, but for public health reasons. If you have to show up to work to get a paycheck, but by showing up to work, you're not practicing social distancing and you're putting us all at risk, you know, that is a public problem. So the paid leave provisions, there is a good reason that they exist. They're not how I would have written them. I think we are going to see the Senate, as the president said yesterday, make them even better. The way they work in the bill now is it's a mandate. You have to pay your workers. And then on the back end, next year, you as a small business are going to get a tax credit that's going to help you recoup that money. That is a long-term debt issue, a tolerance for debt issue that makes small businesses really worried. That's not how I would have written it, but the paid leave does have a good reason for existing. Some of the other provisions in there's an expansion of unemployment insurance. We're not seeing a big unemployment crisis at this time. Of course, we know that employment was as high as ever just before this crisis. So the expansion of unemployment insurance doesn't really make sense to me. Maybe down the road, but not quite yet. But I got to say, Sandy, this bill is not nearly as concerning as the economic stimulus or bailout that we see coming down the road a week or two from now, perhaps even this week.
All right, so that's going to be like for airlines, the travel industry, right? Is that the bailouts you're talking about?
Those are the first two that come to mind, although, you know, these things have a tendency to snowball out of control, and not all industries are the same. The airlines make sense to everybody. That's the one that comes to mind. I've heard the casinos are asking for a bailout. I've heard that Broadway may need a bailout. Hollywood, because no one's going to the movies right now. These are industries that are much more dubious in terms of their need for a bailout than the airlines are. When I say bailout, what I mean is the federal government just shoveling cash to companies to help keep them open when their finances dry up. When the government does that, it takes away all incentive for the foreseeable future for firms to manage their finances in a responsible way. It tells big businesses, don't worry, if you go through troubled waters, the federal government will be there to get you through. Spend all your cash now, don't save it, don't manage your business in such a way that you'll never need help from the federal government, because if you do, you can get it. It's a very bad precedent, and that's what I'm very worried about.
You know, that's the thing that that really bothers me too, Tommy. Like the Democratic candidates debating Sunday night, everything from almost every Democrat and Republican is, don't worry about it, we'll give you more money, we'll give you money, we'll pay you this. It's money, money, money being thrown at everything. And you're on the front lines of this, and you watch the spending very carefully. This is the thing that bothers me. Because I feel we are on the brink. We're not sure when the whole thing's going to crack and we're going to fall into some abyss financially. We're just not sure. Nobody really knows where that is. But people are saying, yes, but these are health risks. This is life and death. How can you talk about money? I'd love to know what your response to that is.
Well, when there is economic trouble, when there is financial trouble, when we are in a recession or a depression, that is a health risk as well. People's lives are at stake with the economic health of this country. And so, yes, coronavirus is serious, and I look out on our society and I see us taking it seriously. But the cost of this will have pretty grave effects now. You know, it's not just how much luxury can we afford, but for many Americans, it's, you know, how long can we shoestring our budget together? So I do think the financial crisis is just as serious as the health crisis here. And you mentioned spending. Here's why you can sense a grave tone in my voice. We are already running a $1 trillion deficit, and that's at a time where the economy was booming, where federal revenue was extraordinarily high because companies and businesses were doing well and paying a lot of taxes. So if you add to that situation a fiscal downturn, and then you have to have, you know, the first number quoted by the Democrats was $750 billion. In my mind, I've gone ahead and doubled that because I know how this works. $750 billion from the Democrats means the Republicans get $750 billion for their own interests. And now you've got $1.5 trillion in one shot. You're going to do that in 1 year and add that to the deficit in the middle of a financial crisis. I got to say, Sandy, that is a perfect storm for a death spiral for the economy. It is that serious.
Yes, I know it is. But I don't think people actually stop to think about this. And certainly even the Republicans are so bad about this. Mitch McConnell is terrible. He seems to love these big spending bills. He always signs off on them as long as they get their, you know, their stuff. The Democrats can get their stuff, and that's been going on since the Obama years, just with almost no restraints. Even, you know, Mitt Romney, the Republican with quotes, is proposing to give every single American $1,000. And Senator Cotton now is weighing in. He wants to give monthly checks to low-income and middle-class Americans during this outbreak. So I'm just saying there is no financial concern, it seems, by Republican leadership. And I guess where's Tom Coburn when we need him? But it's going to go to the Senate today. So what do you think is going to happen there?
Well, so there are two ways this could go in the Senate. One is it could pass. The Senate needs 60 votes. And to be honest, this package probably has 60 votes. But in order to pass a package with only 60 votes, it takes a few days because of the filibuster in the Senate. So one senator, and there are many more than one, that oppose this package could slow it down for a few days. So in exchange for a speedier process, Mitch McConnell could offer those senators that oppose this package amendments or amendment votes. And so the package could change slightly before it exits the Senate. Of course, we know that if it changes, it will have to go back to the House, and the House is out of town. They may have to pass it by unanimous consent. The change that is most likely, the change that Senator Rick Scott from Florida, for example, is searching for, is a change that puts less pressure on small business. If this bill passes and you are a small business, you are now required to pay your employees who aren't working. You'll get a tax credit later on down the road, but for next week's payroll, you have to make it, and you didn't get those employees working. And so that's a real challenge for those businesses. So they're looking for some relief for that situation, and the big question surrounding this bill is whether or not that paid leave provision will change. We'll all find out together. It either will pass as is, or those senators will be able to extract that change from the majority leader.
So basically, psychologically, what's happening is the
sorry.
You've got somebody coming up in the ranks. So sweet, Tommy. Anyway, so you've got politicians who are trying to make sure that no one suffers in any way, and in the process of doing that, they are putting our country really further on the brink of disaster financially. So I don't know what the answer is, Tommy. I guess none of us do. But I guess restraint would be a good start. Tommy Binion from Heritage.
Restraint and prayer. We know that we need to stay in prayer and we need to stick together. And we can do those things for sure today.
Yes. Thank you, Tommy, for that reminder. Tommy Binion, Heritage Foundation. Tommy, thanks so much. Talk to you soon. All right, Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. In the dark of night, Nancy Pelosi produced an emergency funding bill due to the Wuhan coronavirus. She produced the bill at 11 p.m., and the House of Representatives passed it the next day in a 415-2 vote. Senior White House officials have confirmed that Fancy Nancy tried to sneak a $1 billion federal funding guarantee for abortion into the bill. She tried to use the Wuhan virus as cover to guarantee abortion funding. Thankfully, her plot was foiled. But what other goodies could be lurking in the $8.3 billion spending measure?
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Hello, I'm Don Hawkins, here to tell you about Encouragement Live. 55 minutes of industrial strength radio encouragement featuring resourceful guests plus practical biblical insights to help you face life's challenges. We'll be taking your phone calls, so plan to join us for Encouragement Live, Saturdays at 7.05 p.m. Central, 8.05 p.m. Eastern, here on American Family Radio.
When I say the word faithful, what comes to mind? You might think of your spouse, your pastor, or that old college buddy who's always been there for you. At American Family Coffee, we think of our newest blend of coffee. Made from Ethiopia Yirgacheffa beans, this flavorsome coffee is a lighter roast with a mild body, delicious hot or cold. Look for Faithful and an assortment of other blends of American Family Coffee at afastore.net.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. The world is in an all-consuming panic over coronavirus. Some entire countries have shut down, and states have shut down churches, restaurants, schools, and businesses. But the facts are these. Unless you're over 70 and have an underlying health issue, you've got almost nothing to worry about. Less than 100 people have died of the virus this year in the U.S., but last year, 80,000 Americans died from the ordinary seasonal flu. The Bible tells us to respond with faith, not fear, and faith is the calm but resolute refusal to panic. Let's be sensible, wash our hands, stay home if we're sick. Let's show the world how God's men and women respond to a crisis. Let's keep our heads about us while everyone else is losing theirs.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Amidst Wall Street's continuing freefall and the nation's struggle to adapt to social distancing, it's important to bear in mind how we got here. A helpful online resource is China Uncensored's YouTube channel. Host Chris Chappelle's latest video identifies 8 steps the Chinese Communist Party has utilized to manage and then spin the coronavirus that was unleashed worldwide from its original and still worse hot zone in Wuhan. They include the initial official denials of the outbreak and subsequent cover-up that contributed enormously to the pandemic spread and subsequent efforts to boast about the party's totalitarian efforts to suppress it and its people. We're supposed to believe that communism is a cure for the coronavirus. Yesterday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo diplomatically but sternly repudiated the latest Chinese gambit, blaming us for the Wuhan virus. Such propaganda adds deep insult to tremendous injury. This is Frank Gaffney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
The Buckeye State will have to wait, but you know, let's at least address this campaign trail has never looked like this. Yesterday, Sanders holding a virtual rally featuring rocker Neil Young and activist Daryl Hannah, telling supporters to, quote, stream the burn, while Biden held a tele town hall answering voters' questions over the phone. But As it relates to Ohio, they'll have to wait 3 months at least. Ohio's governor and secretary of state announcing last night that the only thing more important than free and fair elections there is the health and safety of Ohioans, ordering the polls closed, postponing the election at least until June. Governor Mike DeWine had this to say.
On the one hand, we're being told to stay home and take care of ourselves, and yet we want to exercise our constitutional rights. And so that was something that, we wanted to enable people to be able to do both.
Meanwhile, three other states, Florida, Illinois, and Arizona, will head to the polls today, where there's a total of 441 delegates up for grabs. Florida has the most, 219. Governor Ron DeSantis explains.
The health officials say, given the nature of this primary, given kind of the way you go in and do one oval most of the time for most counties, that that can be done safely.
And in case you lost track, here's where the race stands coming into today. Biden holds a lead of more than about 150 delegates. In Washington State, just we learned today, declared Biden the winner of last week's primary, giving him victories in five of six states that voted March 10th. So we'll have to see what happens. You know, looking ahead, there are three other states that have already postponed: Louisiana, Georgia, and Kentucky, guys.
These are wild times, aren't they? This is really kind of amazing. But if you live in Illinois or Arizona or Florida, you have to vote today. So go out there and do that and take precautions. But you'll be just fine. And remember that the Freedom Caucus has a couple of candidates that they're really rooting for in Illinois. Again, that's nonpartisan. The Freedom Caucus is not Republican or Democrat. It just so happens that the only conservatives in the House right now happen to be Republicans, but it's two, Jeannie Ives, and I'm sorry, I should have looked up Mary's last name. You guys find her name for me. She's in Southern Illinois. Mary. She is a candidate in Illinois today, and Freedom Caucus is are supporting her. And one other thing, while I'm thinking about it, St. Patrick was living in 400 A.D., obviously not B.C. That was the dumbest thing I think I ever said, but I just thought I would correct that, because obviously he would not be talking about Jesus in 400 B.C. So just thought I would correct that. That's a great story, by the way. And if you missed the opening of the show and you didn't hear about who St. Patrick really was, we put that on our Facebook page, and you'll want to read that, because it is just such a great story. He was an evangelist from Britain who was taken away by the Druids forcibly from his home, and ended up evangelizing Ireland as a grown man. He went back. It's an amazing story. Mary Miller, that's her name. That's the girl in the southernmost part of Illinois. And Jeannie Ives is the one in northern Illinois who the Freedom Caucus is supporting. All right, so I want to tell you some other things. How about that? Would you like to talk about something besides the coronavirus? I thought you might, because a lot of things have been happening. Did you think maybe there might be other news besides the coronavirus? Do you think anything is happening anywhere in the world besides that? I sort of think so. I do think that maybe, having everything thing shut down has cut down on some of the mischief. Maybe that's good, but not all of it. So I want to bring you up to date on some of these investigations that we have spent so much time talking about. I told you the Judicial Watch had received an order from a federal judge that the freedom to subpoena Hillary Clinton and also Cheryl Mills. Also, as I recall, it's Google and some of the documents that Judicial Watch suspects that they have related to Hillary Clinton's. I just feel like when I say email scandal, it's just too trite. This is the situation where the Secretary of State for the United States of America carelessly and intentionally, it seems, created her own private server so that she could communicate with people without the protection of government lockdowns against foreign powers. And so we know that at least one foreign power, and we believe it was China, was able to intercept and read every single thing that the American Secretary of State shared, including correspondence with the President of the United States. It was a breach of, not protocol. It was a breaking of rules and regulations that any other person in foreign service, whether it's the FBI or the CIA or the State Department, would have been fired, fined, jailed for doing what she did, and yet nothing happened to her. So the issue is still being adjudicated because of Judicial Watch's work, and I want to read to you what's happened. So Cheryl Mills and Hillary Clinton and others were supposed to be coming before Judicial Watch to be questioned under oath. So this is what happened yesterday. Judicial Watch announced today, meaning yesterday, that lawyers for former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and her former Chief of Staff Cheryl Mills have asked the Court of Appeals to overturn a U.S. District Court order granting Judicial Watch's request for their depositions about Clinton's email and Benghazi attack records. Lawyers for Clinton and Mills filed a petition for writ of mandamus earlier today. The Clinton request comes in Judicial Watch's lawsuit that seeks records concerning talking points or updates on the Benghazi attack. Remember that Judicial Watch famously uncovered the 2014 talking points that provided Susan Rice's false statements on all the networks after the Benghazi attack. And it was because of that Freedom of Information Act through Judicial Watch that we found out about this private server that Mrs. Clinton had, and that was in 2015. So I'm going to come back to the details, but just to be very clear, the lawyers for Hillary Clinton and Cheryl Mills are asking a judge to stop this. No, we shouldn't have to do that. Stop, please stop. It's a district court, the U.S. District Court in D.C., and they're asking them to stop Hillary and Cheryl Mills from having to testify, under oath for Judicial Watch. So here's the background a little bit. On March 3rd of 2020, Judge Lamberth granted Judicial Watch's request to depose Clinton about her emails and Benghazi attack documents. The court also ordered the deposition of Cheryl Mills and two other State Department officials. It also granted Judicial Watch's request to subpoena Google for relevant documents and records associated with Clinton's emails during her tenure at the State Department. Okay, so Judge Lamberth has been involved in this for a long time. In December of 2018, he first ordered discovery into whether Secretary Clinton's use of private email server was intended to stymie a FOIA. Oh, there's just, this gets in the weeds too much, I recognize. So let me move ahead. The court ruled that the Clinton email system was one of the gravest modern offenses to government transparency. And so the State and Justice Departments continue to defend Clinton, and it's my understanding that the State Department and the Justice Department to this day have prevented discovery on her email, the things that she wrote. They've been surrounding the wagons around Mrs. Clinton now. And Judicial Watch has found, through this judge, they've managed to penetrate that. And now the lawyers for Hillary Clinton and Cheryl Mills are fighting this. And so we'll see what the D.C. Circuit does and if they come to Mrs. Clinton's aid or rescue, or if they agree with Judge Royce Lamberth that something needs to happen, that something really rotten has happened here, and that she needs to be held account and to tell the truth. Because remember, the FBI treated her with kid gloves, and Cheryl Mills, too. Cheryl Mills and the other aide, whose name escapes me in this moment, were allowed to keep their laptops. No one ever went into them and tried to discover what was in there. Of course, they had email from Hillary on this fake server. They knew all about Benghazi. But it was a non-investigation investigation. They didn't even put Hillary Clinton under oath. So it's pretty stunning how the FBI and the Justice Department treated Mrs. Clinton. It was just wrong. It would be the opposite of what they did with President Trump and Lieutenant General Flynn, for that matter. They completely treated them with such disrespect, tried to set them up and entrap them. Their own Justice Department did this to them. And meanwhile, with Hillary Clinton, they broke the law to try to, they have been breaking the law and obstructing to try to protect her. Okay, so you can see what we talk about when we're talking about the deep state. All right, so here's the latest on General Flynn. Speaking of General Flynn, Sidney Powell, his attorney, basically, let me do it this way. The president came out with a tweet on Sunday, and he said, this has been such an injustice to General Flynn, his family, and the American people. Actually, that is not his writing. This is his tweet. Sorry. This is from President Trump. So now it is reported that after destroying his life and the life of his wonderful family and many others also, the FBI, working in conjunction with the Justice Department, has lost the records of General Michael Flynn. How convenient. I'm strongly considering a full pardon. And so that was the president on Sunday. And yes, the records, they say they've lost them. We've been telling you this, but there's so much detail I don't expect you to remember. And one of the main things they've lost is the original report, the FBI 302 report, suddenly disappeared. And that's the Report that agents write out by hand after they, or maybe they type it now into the system, but they used to do it by hand. It was their recall of what they just did when they interviewed someone. And it wasn't admissible in court at the time, as I recall, but it was the notes, you know, the notes were kept for other purposes. But the FBI claims they lost that 302 of the interview with General Flynn when the FBI agents went into the White House and ambushed him and did not tell him that he was actually in jeopardy. That was Peter Strzok. And so I want to read further. Sidney Powell is saying that General Flynn would wear that pardon like a badge of honor because he knows the truth. Sidney says, my personal hope would be for the DOJ to come forward by March 20th with the original FBI 302. The January 30 memo that proves Flynn was exonerated and how he briefed the Defense Intelligence Agency on all of his foreign contacts, including Russia and Turkey. The DOJ needs to produce the truth and give the American people the truth about what the FBI did to Flynn. So there's a lot more to that, but I want to move to this. John Solomon wrote an article, what is this dated, yesterday. And this is what he has found. A little noticed letter from Special Counsel Robert Mueller's office divulges Obama DOJ concerns about the FBI treatment of General Flynn. Former Acting Attorney General Sally Yates, remember she's the one that President Trump fired, so she's no friend to the president, but she and other senior Obama-era Justice Department officials told the Russia special prosecutor in private interviews that they had concerns about the FBI's conduct in investigating former Trump National Security Advisor Mike Flynn. They have memos to this effect. The documents, which include a letter from Special Counsel Mueller's team transmitting exculpatory evidence to Flynn's defense lawyers in 2018, offer the most detailed montage to date about why Attorney General Bill Barr recently appointed a special prosecutor to review the government's actions in the Flynn case. Mueller's team accepted Flynn's guilty plea on a charge of lying about his conversations with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, even though agents told the DOJ they thought the former general was not lying and simply had a faulty memory. DOJ officials believed the threat to the FBI was using to prosecute Flynn under an obscure law known as the Logan Act was a stretch. Flynn was lured by the FBI into a fateful interview with agents, believing he was not in legal jeopardy, which caused him not to seek a lawyer. And then some of the DOJ officials' assessments to the Mueller team were backed up by former Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe. And then John goes in and he writes about each of those things in detail. Bottom line is, even the Obama officials in the Justice Department still carried over, believed that the FBI was doing things they should not have done in setting Michael Flynn up. And so that's an amazing article. I also then want to tell you that yesterday something really big happened. The Department of Justice dropped so let me put it this way. One of the things that the Mueller team did, remember they indicted these so-called Russian companies who they accused of buying Facebook ads and trying to, you know, undermine our elections. Do you remember that? They made much of that, how they did. They indicted 13 Russian nationals, charging them with that. Well, yesterday, the DOJ dropped the charges against the one company that came and fought back. You might remember the prosecutor. I told you about him at the time. He was full of fire. And he actually started his claim. He said the DOJ could indict the proverbial ham sandwich. He mocked them in court, the Mueller team, because there was nothing there. The ads were, it was all made up to cover the Mueller team and justify their narrative that there was Russian collusion. And now we know the difference. Now we know that's not true. And so all the charges have been dropped. And by the way, the attorney in that case said, I find it disturbing that you are already behaving in a manner that is inconsistent with the practices of the DOJ. There was a lot more to be said about that, but that case has been dropped and it is egg all over the Mueller team's face. All right, Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.